Listen to the voices of our world.
Basically, we can have no hope of stanching nuclear weapons proliferation until we deal with this double standard hypocrisy and begin fulfilling our treaty commitments. At this point, for those of us who have concern about the possibility of a U.S. attack against Iran, what we need to be urging is that our government engage in direct negotiations with the Iranians and that we also make a pledge of non-aggression. I think we need to begin to think in less hysterical ways here in the United States and move ahead in a thoughtful way that ensures security.
Welcome to Voices of Our World, a presentation of this station and Maryknoll. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. Since the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, each and every U.S. president has threatened nuclear war at some point during their presidency. Join us as we speak with leading nuclear specialist and peace campaigner Joseph Gerson about how the United States has used nuclear weapons to bolster its imperial ambitions and how the United States uses them today to preserve its global empire. That's today on Voices of Our World. Empire and the Bomb is the latest book from Joseph Gerson, who serves as the director of programs of the American Friends Service Committee in New England. Drawing from a wide range of sources, including extensive government documents, he explains how and why the United States has made more than 20 threats of nuclear attack during the Cold War against Russia, China, Vietnam, and the Middle East. And he shows how such threats have continued under Presidents Bush, Clinton, and George W. Bush. Our producer, Michael Ramadan Jones, recently sat down with Joseph Gerson. Here's his interview.
Well, I'd like to start with the title. The title of the book is Empire and the Bomb, How the U.S. Uses Nuclear Weapons to Dominate the World. What is the U.S. empire, and how are we dominating the world?
Well, what I've described in the book is what I learned, among other things, when I was being trained for the U.S. Foreign Service ages ago, that the United States has long been an empire, that the founders of this country, their models were the British, French, Roman, Greek empires. And what they created in the Constitution was a framework for creating an empire. I outlined how we basically conquered the continent, created a continental empire. And then how, beginning really with the Spanish-American War, conquests of Puerto Rico, Cuba, Guam, Philippines, annexation of Hawaii, the United States began the process of building its global empire, which has now been reinforced by things like the International Monetary Fund, the G8, and so on. In terms of dominance, declared U.S. policy from the Pentagon was called full-spectrum dominance. A commitment to be able to dominate any country anywhere in the world at any time, at any level of power. Empires don't exist on cream puffs and chocolate. But in fact, the United States, as I describe in the book, has, among other things, prepared and threatened to initiate nuclear war on at least 30 occasions in order to ensure its global domination.
Let's go back to the beginning of World War II, and we're told of this decision that we had to make between saving U.S. soldiers' lives and prolonging the war. What is the truth about our use of the bomb in World War II and the moral decision behind it?
Well, the Asian-Pacific theater of the Second World War was really quite different from the European theater. In Asia, the war grew out of an imperial competition between Japan, the United States, and Britain for dominance in Asia, and especially for control of China at the time. And we see in the end of the war, again, a manifestation of this. So on the one hand, as you say, there's this myth which was generated by President Truman and others that the atomic bombings saved so many U.S. lives. But in fact, at the time, and actually for almost a year, the most senior leaders in the U.S. government, including President Truman, understood that Japan was a defeated nation, that it was attempting to surrender, and attempting to surrender on terms that the U.S. eventually accepted, that the emperor remain on the throne. There are multiple reasons why the bombs were dropped, and just understand that the city of Hiroshima was completely destroyed in 9 seconds, and people are continuing to die from the radiation of that atomic explosion to this day. But the reasons, on the one hand, there was bureaucratic momentum. Truman's political mentor, Burns, who he made Secretary of State, was advising him that if the U.S. people learned that $2 billion had been spent to build the bomb and that it wasn't used, that he'd be in jeopardy come the 1948 presidential elections. But the really determining factor for Burns and for many others was to bring the war to an immediate end before the Soviets could intervene. They were supposed to join the war on August the 15th. The idea here being to prevent having to share influence in Asia, as was already the case in Europe, where the U.S. Had to share influence after the war with the Soviet Union. The fear was we'd have to share influence in Manchuria, in northern China, in Korea. And the second reason is Truman wrote in his diaries, with the bomb, he'd have a hammer over those boys.
One of the thoughts I had was the fact that the moral implications of dropping these bombs on the Japanese people never seemed to come up in our discussion. The moral implication is implied in terms of American lives, but not in terms of Japanese lives.
Well, if we allow ourselves to think about this, it becomes quite subversive. Actually, at the time, Secretary of War Stimson advised Truman that between the U.S. firebombings of the Japanese cities, and we had basically burned 62 cities to the ground, and the atomic bombings, that the United States could get the reputation of competing with Hitler in atrocities. That's a direct quote. The Smithsonian Institution, which would have provided the history, would have included statements by President Eisenhower, by Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Leahy and others, that Japan was attempting to surrender, that it could surrender on terms acceptable to the U.S., that we didn't have to hit them with this horrible thing, and which also had many photographs of the damage done and of the victims of the atomic bombing. This was blocked by the Air Force and by very conservative members of Congress. So, you know, it's one more manifestation of the fact that if this kind of dominance is going to be practiced, the U.S. people have to be kept ignorant of what's happening. And this is something to which the United States will, one way or another, have to be held accountable for.
So when the U.S. says all options are on the table, in many ways they're hinting that they'll commit a war crime.
It's not a hint. I mean, it's basically a threat. And we're in that moment right now.
This is Voices of Our World, a weekly program dedicated to the issues of human rights, poverty, and social justice. Visit our website at voicesofourworld.org to learn more about Voices of Our World and Barry Knoll. Now back to our interview with author Joseph Gerson, the Director of Programs of the American Friends Service Committee in New England, whose new book is titled Empire and the Bomb. You're listening to Voices of Our World.
Have we been sold a false bill of goods about what our nukes are meant for?
During the 1960 presidential election, John Kennedy ran on the basically on the slogan, on the belief that there was a missile gap and that we were very much in danger from the Soviet Union. Actually, when he came to power in the transition, President Eisenhower informed him that we really didn't have anything to fear from the Soviet nuclear arsenal. And that if nuclear weapons were used, the greatest danger to the United States would be fallout from our bombs. Come the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Soviet Union at that time had four intercontinental ballistic missiles. We knew where all of them were, and they could reach the United States. And their bomber fleet was slow and very accessible to U.S. Warplanes. So at the height of the missile crisis, when we were all thinking it was something like, you know, a confrontation between two equals, Carl Kaysen, who was Kennedy's principal strategic advisor, informed him that the United States could launch a first strike nuclear attack against the Soviet Union with great confidence that there'd be no retaliation. So basically, the U.S. maintained this position of overwhelming dominance well into the 1970s, and then when the Soviets achieved parity, you had the development, deployment of a whole new generation of nuclear weapons in an effort to re-achieve this first strike ability. In terms of the times that the U.S. has used its nuclear arsenal, it goes back as early as 1946 during a crisis in Iran when Truman essentially threatened to annihilate Moscow if the Soviets didn't withdraw from a region of northern Iran that we had urged them to occupy during the Second World War so we could provide them with supplies. Vietnam in 1954, when we offered the French and Germans, French and English, a couple of atomic bombs to break the siege there. 1967, during the siege of Khe Sanh, huge threat in 1969, Nixon's November ultimatum, when he had U.S. nuclear forces deployed, high alert for almost a month. And this was a kind of a practice. Nixon called it the man-man approach. He learned it from President Eisenhower, both in relationship to Korea and China.
I guess in today's current events, there are three nuclear situations that are particularly interesting, the first being with Iran, obviously. Mm-hmm. How can we possibly say to another country that they cannot have technology that we already have?
Well, this is the fundamental hypocrisy that really lies at the core of it all. And interestingly, more recently, in an op-ed article written in the Wall Street Journal by former Secretaries of State Henry Kissinger and George Shultz and Clinton's former Secretary of Defense Perry, in which they say that the U.S. nuclear arsenal is now counterproductive, that this double standard is, in fact, helping to fuel nuclear weapons proliferation. So basically, we can have no hope of stanching nuclear weapons proliferation until we deal with this double standard hypocrisy and begin fulfilling our treaty commitments.
Also recently, it was in Israel where the prime minister made a slip of the tongue and apparently admitted that finally that Israel, even though the whole world seemed to already knew it, that Israel also had nuclear weapons. Why was the secrecy maintained? What is the philosophy behind maintaining your nuclear arsenal a secret?
Yeah, actually, Israel has had its nuclear bomb since even before the 1967 war. It developed it with French assistance as sort of a consolation prize for being suckered into invading Egypt in 1956 and being forced to withdraw. The Israeli approach has been that if they made it public, if they ballyhooed the existence of the nuclear arsenal, this would put the neighboring Arab states in an embarrassing position and essentially force or encourage them under popular pressure to develop nuclear arsenals of their own. This has been the way the game has been played until recently. The Arab states, for the most part, have called for the negotiation of a nuclear weapons-free zone, which I think is a wonderful concept, and one which needs to be brought back into consideration as we deal with the possibility of proliferation not only in Iran, but the possibility of proliferation throughout the Arab world in response not so much to the Israeli bomb as to an Iranian bomb.
Does America practice imperialism? Let us know your opinion. Email us at radio@maryknoll.org or go to our website, www.voicesofourworld.org. Or you can call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. You're listening to Voices of Our World.